薄いのアホ。
プリズムパワーメイクアップカードレ
ディー。 Welcome to Shoujo and Tell, where we discuss shoujo manga and tell who's hot and who's not, talk about themes, and just generally geek out. Today, January 13th, 2018, our first episode recorded in the new year, will be Shoujo and Telling about The Key to the Kingdom by Kyoko Shito. I'm your host, Ashley McDonald, and I'm joined by Megan D. Armin.
Hello!
Hey! Alright, so obviously, Megan, who are you? Tell us a little about yourself.
Alright, my name is Megan. I've been reviewing manga for going into my sixth year now on my own little blogspot site, The Manga Test Drive. Some of you in this last year might have seen the articles I did for Anime Feminist, first one being the Jose Renaissance, and the second one being an analysis of Everyone's Getting Married.
Ooh. So yeah, what are some of your favorite shoujo series?
Well, I've been in shoujo from the start. I admittedly got a later start in manga than a lot of people. I didn't get into it till like my mid-20s. But the first series I ever read was Magic Knight Rayearth by Clamp. So ever since, I've been a complete sucker for their works, and that one remains one of my favorites. These days, besides from kind of shoujo-adjacent works, things like The Ancient Magus' Bride and The Girl from the Other Side, let me see, I really liked My Love Story. Mm. I love From Eroica with Love. I'm totally into old-school shoujo. And Requiem for the Rose King by Aya Kano, The Womanhood Otomon, which is this fantastic pastiche of Richard III.
Hmm. Yeah. I can tell that you're into old shoujo because, like, The Key to the Kingdom is definitely old school style. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things about it. I'm glad you brought it up right away. Because yeah. If you just look at the cover art, how old would you say this series is?
I mean, just based on the cover art, I'd be like, oh, 80s, maybe early 90s. But I know it's, like, newer than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I made the same presumption. I looked at that art like, oh, this is like classic 90s shoujo art. And then I look at the copyright. Oh, this is from 2004. This would have been fairly recent as far as CMX titles go.
Yeah, but it's definitely, it feels older than that.
Absolutely.
All right, so I guess we should mention that The Key to the Kingdom was published by the now defunct CMX, which I didn't know used to be an imprint of DC Comics. Kind of blew my mind a little.
Yes, this was their response to the whole manga boom, which admittedly was smarter than Marvel, doing things like hiring white guys to pretend to be Asian writers, but so yes, they did own CMX. Unfortunately, they didn't give it a lot of money or attention, so there was a lot of great manga they picked up that just flew under everybody's radar until they went out of business in 2008. As far as shoujo goes, most people tend to remember a lot of the old school stuff they picked up. Stuff like Swan, From Eroica with Love, Cypher. But they also picked up a lot of relatively recent titles. Things like Land of the Blindfolded, Makudesu. They put out the first release of Phantom Thief Jean by Irina Tanimura. Managed to snatch that up from Viz.
Yeah. I feel like I didn't know about CMX back in the day. Like, I don't remember reading any titles from them. I don't remember knowing their name. It's only more recently that I've come to know them. Like, all right, I don't know how this happened.
Yeah, they kind of flew under the radar of everybody but manga bloggers. And that's how I kind of got into the fandom. So that's how I knew about a lot of this stuff.
All right, that makes, yeah, because I was like, this would have been the height of me, like, going to bookstores and buying manga. So, like, I just don't understand how this happened, but
oh, that could be a podcast onto itself.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, so I guess this unfortunately means that, you know, this series is out of print. If you're lucky, maybe your library still has it. All the used copies that I bought were from libraries, and I'm pretty sure the Alamito one was like, oh, this went out of circulation in 2014, which is like kind of recently, so maybe you get lucky.
Yeah, the good news is at least it's not a heavily coveted one, like, say, some of those Eroica volumes, as I found out firsthand. So, while it's pretty much only available secondhand, you can pick it up pretty cheap.
Yeah, you can get it for, like, half the price of a new thing, so yeah, so I guess we should, you know, tell the people what The Key to the Kingdom is actually about. Do you want to give a short plot synopsis?
Sure. So in the Kingdom of Landon, which is in the middle of the Civil War, the king and the crown prince, Winslot, both die in battle. And that leaves basically a power gap where there's various people competing for the throne. There's the surviving prince, Astarion. There's Duke Alan, the general, I believe, not Thaddeus, that's somebody else.
Bardas,
thank you. I keep confusing it. And so it's eventually decided to send everybody out on this quest for the Fire Emblem. I mean, the key to the kingdom. This symbol of royalty, and whoever gets it first gets to be king. And they have to complete this quest within 2 years. So these various parties set out, including the Prince Astarion, or Asta, as he's generally known, who's very prissy and bookish and has no interest in ruling. And worse still, he's sent off with a soldier and friend of his late brother named Badarius, a.k.a. Bad, who is very womanizing and goofy and...
Badass with a sword.
badass with a sword. Asta's very pacifist. And as their quest goes on, they learn a lot more about the dark history of the kingdom, about the dragons that used to roam the land, and what the true meaning of the key to the kingdom is. And it ends up becoming not so much a quest to prove kingship, but a quest to save the kingdom.
Yeah, I think this definitely went in unexpected ways for me. I was like, I didn't expect the story to go there. I thought there would actually be a real key. I'm a fool. I know nothing.
But honestly, I love the direction it took. But then I really like shoujo fantasy, as if the fact that the first manga I ever read was Magic Knight Rayearth didn't give it away. I've always been a sucker for shoujo fantasy. And it's a genre that's never completely fallen to the wayside, but it's definitely not as common as it used to be like a decade or two ago.
Yeah, I definitely feel like it's gone more realistic.
But yeah, maybe I was drawn to this just because, like, oh, shoujo, fantasy, dragons. You know what this reminds me of? Escaflowne!
Escaflowne, best anime!
it is one of my favorites. It was one of the first I ever saw. And yeah, that was also probably a big influence on why I like this series so much. Because, again, outside of some of the few manga bloggers I saw review it, nobody talks about this series. Nobody remembers it except me. Nobody loves it except me.
Oh, well, now I love it. Because, yeah, I was like, oh, man, if I had known about this, it definitely just appeals to Escaflowne fans.
Oh, absolutely.
And Escaflowne was definitely one of my first anime, like the thing that got me into anime, basically. So, yeah, I guess I wish I had known about this series back in the day. But, no, I only knew about it because you suggested it.
So, yeah. It's not a series most people are familiar with, which is a terrible shame. But before we get too far into the spoilers, what was your favorite thing or things about it in general?
I liked that, like, even though it's pretty simplistic and whatever, I was like, I feel so emotionally invested in all these characters. I really liked Bod and Asta's playing off each other. I was just like, oh, I love all of you. I want good things to happen to you. Yeah, I don't know. It went in unexpectedly deeper directions than I really thought it was going to at first. More mystery than I really thought there was going to be. Yeah.
The good thing you bring up the writing is, upon rereading this for the podcast, I was really struck by just how good the writing is. This is not a long series. This is 6 volumes. But it is just tight and precise, and the twists come at just the right spots. And as you mentioned, there's really good character writing. It's not necessarily revolutionary, but it's all handled really well, and particularly the evolution of characters like Asta over the series is just, it's really remarkable. And the thing is, Kyoko Shito has not done a lot of work. Aside from this, she's done like a couple of other short series, but otherwise basically disappeared from the manga scene. And it's kind of a shame.
That's sad because, yeah, this was so... I was like, we've all seen all these character archetypes before, but they're just done so well. Like, yeah, they have... Every time a big character beat comes, you're like, oh, you did so much in this one chapter. So good.
Also, it's kind of out of nowhere. I also love how strange the character... Not the character designs. I do like the character designs, though. I love how retro they are with the big, shiny, clamp-style eyes. And she does manage
hair.
To square off, oh, the hair. And she does manage to square off their chins a little so it's not pure Dorito chin. But I also love how fantastical and strange and ugly the creature designs are. Like, that was unexpected. But also things like, later on, there's a mystic who's, like, fused with, like, at the waist with this weird, like, lizard creature, or these creepy elf heads that appear in flowers, or the graveyard weeds with their skeletal faces. Like, it's weird yeah. and spooky and unexpected, but it's so good.
Yeah, I think the weed thing was where I was like, I don't know why I didn't expect other creepy magical things, but like, this is where I was like, this is where the magic is special. Just like really weird, strange weed creatures that will tell you prophecies if they suck your blood about when you're gonna die. Cool. You probably haven't read this series, which is a shame, but if you do want to read it, you should probably stop listening now, because we will spoil all the things that will happen. We hope we've convinced all you Escaflowne fans that you should go read this, because you should.
Oh yeah, this is definitely for Escaflowne fans, and even people who into more recent similar titles, like maybe Dawn of the Arcana or Yona of the Dawn, anything in that kind of shoujo fantasy vein.
Yes, this is definitely for you. And again, it is a short series, so you can knock it out real quick. Yeah, so from here on out, spoilers ahead. I guess generally I broke it into three arcs in my head, which was like hunt for information about the key initially, like, because they don't even know what the key to the kingdom is. Where do they start? I don't know. So they all break off into different directions and find various mystics to talk to.
And what I love about this, what I like about the first arc, is it's established early on that Astarion is very prissy and bookish and not very imposing as a person, but his bookishness ends up working in his favor through the whole series, and particularly early on. He's the one who's like, no, we gotta research stuff. I brought along books. I'm gonna read this stuff as we go along and talk to people. It's not just necessarily go out there, stab the thing with a sword.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, some other characters are like, let's go out there and stab things with a sword, maybe. Less of that, but more like, I'm just gonna go straight to the heart of things, like, go talk to a mystic and then go where they told me to. So there's definitely good counterbalance with all the characters, good, evil, in between.
It's also the point where the most character building is built up between the various factions, particularly with Asta and Bad, who, upon rereading, I rediscovered this is basically a buddy cop routine, with Asta being the good cop, the one who plays by the rules, and Bad being the bad cop, aka the rebel who doesn't play by the rules, but he gets results when he isn't chasing girls. But yes, that's also probably the most comedy-loaded part of the story.
Oh yeah, definitely. Everything with Bad is like, aha, we turn it into like a sexy joke or, you know, drinking. But I also love him so much. Like, I was like, I don't want to love you, but I definitely do.
That seems to be everybody's reaction, both in and out of the story. Like, I know, right? In some ways, he's a bit of a libidinous lunkhead. But, you know, you see glimpses of somebody who is far loyal and smarter and seems to know everybody in the freaking kingdoms. Like, everyone's like, hey, Bad, yeah, I remember you from such and such a battle.
What's up? Yeah. I mean, that's a good thing. That's networking. It's good.
Yes. But it's also when we start to establish Asta's connection with Leticia, who is another noble girl around his age. And oh my God, I adored her. She's a precious little cinnamon bun.
I know. As soon as she was there, I was like, so Letty is best character, right? But I mean, Bod is really the best character, but Letty close second.
Because she's established as somebody very sweet and outgoing, but she's also more canny than she lets on, and she is able to defend herself. She can handle a sword well.
Yeah, the scene where Asta's like has his turning point of like, oh, Letty was able to defend herself against this thug who tried to rob us. Now maybe I see the lights about wanting to use a sword. I'm like, yes, I like that you now have a purpose for this, Asta, but also Letty. I love that.
Even
you
beat if it's
that
totally
guy.
To impress a girl.
Yeah, totally to impress a girl. I mean, they do fall into. I was kind of disappointed with Letty in the end because it was about, you know, like, oh, she like loses her confidence in the end since Alex dies, and she kind of blames herself for that. And I was like, oh, I feel like this is too close to home about how girls around that age like lose confidence in themselves and then get lost. And but boys flourish at that age, and I'm like, eh, a little too close to home for me. But still loved her overall.
Yeah, but I'd also say it's also arguably the first arc is maybe the weakest, just because it's the most aimless, because everybody's trying to wander around, gather information. And you feel like to some degree Shito is still hammering things out a little, and it doesn't really start to coalesce until she introduces the dragon men.
Yeah, I was definitely like, I don't know, I guess I always struggle with things that are very political and like, why are people trying to backstab these other people and there's lots of parties? But definitely the first arc is like trying to establish all that, and you like only slowly learn about the dragon men. So keeping it all straight in my head, I was like, this is kind of hard and like not that engaging for me. But then, yeah, once it was like by volume like 3, I was like, I'm sold. Let's go. I'm so into it.
Yeah. And the first appearance of the dragon men is what really hooked me, because as I described it to you initially, they meet up with who is basically Shoujo Vampire Hunter D.
It's true. Yeah, that's definitely, I kept trying to place who it reminded me of, and now you've done it.
Yeah, they meet up with a dragon man named Gaius, and yeah, with his giant dark cloak and his giant long-brimmed hat and his long dark hair, yeah, he's basically D.
Yep.
But pretty. So pretty.
But pretty D, yes. Yeah, so I guess that leads into the second arc is like, you know, now that they've all learned about the dragon men and they're become entrenched in their lives, especially with Bad and Fairheart. Fairheart is a duke who is the fifth person vying to find the key to the kingdom.
Yes, as Loan Fairheart, who's basically the Faramir of the group. Like, he's the one who, thanks to plot reasons involving his heritage, cannot be affected by the magic of the dragons. And because of that, and his just general pure-hearted nature, he ends up being one of the few allies Asta and Bad have, and the one who helps them uncover the history of this kingdom and the secrets behind it. And that becomes the core of that second arc, is once they really start to figure out what the key to the kingdom is and what are the invisible towers and what's the secrets behind it. And that, more than anything, is gone to what was really the big draw for the series for me. I think it's in at the end of volume 3, where Aslan, his name?
I don't know how to pronounce his name. Yeah.
Asloan.
Okay. But they definitely spelled it without the E initially, right? And then they started spelling it with an E, and I was like, now you've confused me, CMX.
But yes, when he goes down into like the depths of his castle to uncover the history and the twist about who Gaius and this other dragon man named Sionis are, that was one of the most incredible scenes for me in the entire manga. Like, that was just so well handled.
Yeah, my mind was definitely like, oh, that makes so much sense, but also that's really dope that it came out like that. And I love Sionis and Aslan's, like, in the same way that Bod and Gaius have a really great chemistry. Like, I really liked their chemistry of, like, Sionis is like, I must kill you. Oh, you're like the one person I can't kill. Darn it.
Yes, because we learn there are these two dragon men, Gaius and Sionis. Gaius is the dark shoujo vampire hunter D. Sionis is this beautiful, ethereal blonde who looks like something straight out of Please Save My Earth. And
yeah,
it's established like, oh, 300 years ago, there used to be dragons, and there were dragon tamers who used dark magic to control them and make the dragons fight. And, you know, over the series, we learn that these dragon men have agendas of their own, and a history of their own that involves this king of the dragon tamers who betrayed the king and his disciple. And yeah, that twist, because it turns out that Gaius and Sionis are that king of the dragon tamers and his disciples. Their bodies basically fused with these dragons they consumed. And they're basically two personalities within one body fighting for control. And it's amazing.
Yeah, but mostly the dragons get to control, except for one day a year on the summer solstice, then the dragon tamers come out, and they've been plotting this for 300 years, the search for the key to the kingdom that they've totally is not a real key, and they made people hunt for, it's basically just to resurrect a dragon. I'm like, oh, so well plotted.
Oh god, yes, and all the twists, like all this stuff they've been seeding for centuries about having people meet one another and have kids and placing people and things in just the right places. And yes, it turns out that the whole quest is basically to resurrect the giant earth dragon that the kingdom covers, basically. Their kingdom is a dragon. Your argument isn't valid because their kingdom is a dragon. And yes, it turns out that these invisible towers that everyone is searching for are basically the magical stakes pinning this earth dragon into the ground. And yes, they're basically traps. And if a person basically of royal blood basically is sealed within it, if they die within it, it unlocks it. And then the dragon will be revealed. And it's all just so tightly plotted and the twists are so well paced. It pays off so well.
Yeah, I would say the second arc is basically just everyone realizing what the key is and that they've been tricked into becoming sacrifices, and then dealing with people like Letty gets saved by Alex because he throws himself into the pool and then is a rejected sacrifice. Duke, Alan, and Bardas become sacrifices. Asta's like, wait, we've been tricked. We must not become sacrifices. And Fairheart, Sionis sacrifices himself to save Fairheart so that he doesn't become a sacrifice. And I'm like, oh, it's so good. But also, I really love the believability of this plot of like, yeah, it would take 300 years for this to even become a plausible thing that could happen where they could possibly resurrect the dragon. And I love the scene where, you know, the dragon king guy is explaining, he's like, Gaius always tried to get in my way. Like, on summer solstice, I would wake up and I'd just be on a ravine of rocks in the middle of nowhere so that I didn't have the whole day to, like, seed my plan and stuff. And I'm like, oh, it's so funny. I love Gaius. Gaius, great.
Yes, and during this arc, there's a lot of smaller one going on with the various contenders for the throne. I mean, as you mentioned, Letty is on her own quest. And during that, she falls in love with one of her retainers, Alex, because, you know, he's an older, cute guy, and he says wonderfully noble things to her. And she's a 13-year-old girl, because so of course she falls for that.
Of course.
But unfortunately, she also ends up falling prey to the King of the Dragon Tamer's plot to use her insecurity about Alex, who is himself interested in a mystic they pick up named Latora, to either get him out of the way or try to lure her into the tower. And as you mentioned before, it's kind of depressing because before she's just so bubbly and wonderful. And as the series goes on, you know, she just becomes more and more obsessed with keeping Alex by her side. And afterwards, she's kind of the cutie who is there to be broken, to borrow a phrase or two from TV tropes.
Yeah.
Loss of innocence is a major theme here.
Yeah, definitely. I'm kind of glad that she, like, you know, Asta didn't end up together in the end. I was like, good, we didn't just make a pretty little, nice little packaged ending where they went through these trials and now they're just a cute little couple. I'm like, all right, at least we didn't do that, I guess.
Yes.
But yeah, the last arc is just basically aftermath of, like, now all the secrets have been out. The dragon has failed to be resurrected. But then, you know, the neighboring land has realized that Landor is, like, in chaos fighting over this key to the kingdom. And this neighboring land, Certes, tries to come and invade. And then a dragon fight happens, because inevitably that it would be what happens. But mostly this arc is about Asta finally being like, I don't like war, but I will begrudgingly accept that sometimes we need to do it, but I will try to do it in the least bloodshedding way possible. I will use my smarts to try to really come into this. And he just begrudgingly accepts his role as king, I guess.
I really love where Asta's character went with this. Because before, as mentioned, he honestly is a little bit of a brat. Like, just a very prissy, know-it-all yes. brat. And like a lot of teenagers, when he does get into trouble, he's very much, I have to do this on my own. I have to make it right. I can't rely on anybody else. And it's really in this third arc where it comes into his own, where he has to confront the fact that sometimes you do have to fight for things you protect. But as you mentioned, he does it in his own way. That doesn't necessarily involve brute force. And it's just like, oh.
Yeah, he uses fake soldiers. And I'm like, oh, it's so clever. Like, of course, this dragon tamer man who's on the other side can tell that they're fake, but, you know, there's still a great play of, like, can you trust the dragon tamer man? Does he know everything? Apparently not.
Yes, and him just really really coming into his role as a leader, as somebody that people actually trust. Because all throughout the series, everyone's just like, oh, there's Asta, you know, that weird little prissy boy. He can't be king. Nobody barely noticed him because he was always... Because another thing, he's always been in the shadow of his late brother, Winslot, who was basically princely perfection. You know, he was good and fair and wise and a great soldier, and Asta adored him.
And hot.
And a big part of his arc is Asta kind of getting beyond that and growing into himself, that he doesn't have to be like his brother. He can be himself, but still be a leader. But also mentioning Aslot gets into a kind of a small and weirdly self-contained arc in the third part, where Asta and Bad meet up with Mialane.
I was very confused about why this was a side chapter, because it's very key to the plot.
Yeah, it's one of the few times we see Winslot on his own, because most of the time we only see him in flashback. But through her, Mialane is a princess of a neighboring land called Rommel, and which Landor, Asta's kingdom, invaded and took over. And she's basically set up where she takes this curse from a witch they have prisoner in their dungeons onto her very flesh, into her arms. And whoever she touches first will die from the curse. And she initially means just to get the general, but afterwards she meets Winslot and they fall in love, and she feels conflicted, like, no, don't touch me, I don't want to destroy you. But he takes it on himself anyway, and he ends up dying from it. And it's all terribly noble and romantic and tragic.
Yes, it was everything I love. I loved it so much. I guess it was a side chapter just because it was from his perspective, and that breaks, you know, how the story goes, where it's mostly from Asa's perspective. But I was just like, I don't know, like, the side chapter is really key to a central plot point, which is because Maya comes back and, like, kidnaps Asta and then gives him an important bit of information, which was the grimoire of the Dragon King or whatever. And I'm like, I don't know if I would count that as a side chapter, but all right.
But yes, it all leads up to this descendant of the Dragon King and Bat, who himself has unfortunately fallen under a curse, which was also part of a Faustian deal he made with Gaius, basically where he would sacrifice his life to Gaius so long as he lived long enough to see Asta become king. And as Bad lays dying at one point, Asta's like, no, no, you have to survive. You know, we got this arm and blood of the Dragon King. You have to consume some of it and become a dragon man yourself. And Bad does this, and it becomes a dragon!
Becomes an actual dragon, yeah. An ugly dragon. He'd be so sad if he knew how ugly he was.
Oh, he's not so bad. But yes, they end up having, like, this massive dragon fight.
Massive dragon fight, yeah. Where Bad comes to, like, protect Asta. And then Asta's like, oh no, but if he just keeps protecting me, he'll die too. He's not impervious to other dragons' fires. So then Asta, of course, rides the dragon and then goes and stabs the bad dragon. I'm like, yes, that's what I like.
Yes!
So good.
He rides a dragon, stabs it with a magic sword, and tears out its heart, and it's awesome! And then amazingly, that is not the end. Even though it does feel like that's kind of the climax of the story, because then afterwards you get into the plot with, it's basically wrapping up the civil war with Satanas, and basically just wrapping up all the loose ends from there.
Yeah, it's basically just like this kingdom that was torn apart 300 years ago. It takes a couple more years, so 305 years has been torn apart, but now they've been reunited under King Asa, who now has they call him the Dragon King, because he was able to control Bod Dragon.
And yes, and the sad part is at the very end, is like, Asta knows that Bad, as a dragon, cannot survive, because eventually he will revert completely to his dragon nature and just start rampaging and killing people. But they make a deal. When Asta reaches the end of his life, he will go to Bad and slay Bad.
I know. I'm like, oh,
it's a very tragic end to their friendship. And it's like, oh.
That's a whole other story that I'm like, oh, I wish that could be told, but also that's so sad. I like to believe that, like, some compromise happened where he didn't have to kill Bad the dragon. Bad just, you know, always kind of retained himself and was a good dragon. Good dragon.
But yeah, that covers the plot then. So I guess now's the time to get more into the themes. And
yes,
the big theme here is fate and how much you can defy and how much you can accept it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more in favor of acceptance here than... Well, I was always confused because I feel like, you know, Asta's like, we should defy fate. We just shouldn't go to the place, which is always the logical thing. Like, you know, Bad gets a prediction that he will die in 72 days at the specific place. So they're like, okay, what if we just don't go to that place? And I'm like, yeah, that's always the logical conclusion. But, you know, a series of events makes it so that they go to the place anyway. And I'm just like, yep, you just have to accept that you are going to end up in the place. Oh, I guess their plan had been that they would get there really quickly to leave before that day happened, so they would be far away from that place. But of course, that's a bad plan. I could have advised them that would be a bad plan, because those plans never work out like you think they will. You always take more time. That's the one thing working in tech has always led me to believe, is that, you know, you plan out when a project is going to be done, and then, you know, realistically it'll be done 2 months later, because that's just how time works.
But it also gets into, like, the larger plot with the King and the Dragon Tamers plotting this out for 300 years and kind of forcing these various figures to the towers and trying to get them to seal their fate. But as we see, you know, what they doesn't factor in is things like the power of friendship or just enough intellect to not fall into the trap. Or even things like Asta's whole story arc. I mean, the reason he goes on the quest is he's kind of trying to avoid his fate. He doesn't want to be the heir to the kingdom. He doesn't want to be king. He doesn't want to rule. He just wants to be left alone and read. But over the course of the arc, with meeting all these people and interacting with Bad and learning from him, he comes to accept the role, but in his own way.
Yeah, it's true, because, you know, the whole story kicks off with the whole reason they have to go on the quest for the Key of the Kingdom is exactly because Asta doesn't want to give in to his fate. They're like, okay, Asta doesn't want to be king, and he's not a fighter, so people don't want him to be king, so we'll send
them. We can't just leave
them.
This power void.
Yeah, we can't just leave this void, so if somebody manages to find the Key to the Kingdom within 2 years, like, then they can be king. So it comes full circle where it's like, all right, they went on the quest and that's what made Ask the King. Like, that's what made him qualified to do it, because now he saw more of his kingdom. He was forced to see what battle is like, learn his own way through it and all these things. And I'm like, yep, sad, but also, you know, good, good story.
And another theme that I particularly like, just speaking as a history nerd, is how much emphasis is put on learning from history and getting different perspectives. Asta is the one who mostly does this, though Asluin helps him a lot. Is talking to the various mystics and other figures, he's one of the few people willing to engage the dragon men in conversation to learn their history, their perspective on the events that happened in the past with Asta's ancestors, and try to learn the truth behind what caused the civil war that's tearing apart the Kingdom of Landon, or why there are no more dragons. Which I felt was very powerful and very interesting.
Oh yeah, I definitely felt that was powerful when Sejanus and Gaius were like, well, we can't trust humans, humans don't trust us. Like, there's definitely a lot of trust issues, and like, what information can you believe? Are we really learning from history if we all have different stories that have been distorted over time? Actually, those sorts of like, trust what you've learned, find the true history things are what reminded me also a lot of Escaflowne, because I remember a lot as a child being struck by in Escaflowne, like, it's a very specific scene towards the middle of the series where Alan, who is the chivalrous knight, but who had an affair and, like, has this illegitimate child. So he tells the illegitimate child, like, what takes more courage is to trust someone sometimes than it is to just fight, like, put yourself into a fight. And I was like, that is a central theme in this story where, you know, Sejanus and Gaius are like, well, we don't trust you, you don't trust us, but, like, we're trying to help you genuinely with our limited dragon powers, because apparently dragons can't just tell you the straight truth, they have to speak in riddles or whatever.
Yes.
So I really love the emphasis on trust.
Yes, and Asta's willingness to trust and listen to them ends up saving them on more than one occasion, particularly once the their other personalities come out on the summer solstice.
Yeah. Yeah, and Winslet had given him a similar thing to Alan, where, like, Winslet was like, you know, you have to decide who to trust, but, like, I trust in you that you'll figure it out correctly, so just go with your gut or whatever.
But also the heavy emphasis on fate is also very, very reminiscent of Escaflowne, about defying one's fate versus accepting one's fate. It's just, it's not so much about controlling it as it is finding one's own path.
Yeah, I definitely think that, you know, these stories take a different turn with them, because I feel like Escaflowne is like, in the end, there's some machine. I'm definitely going to spoil Escaflowne, but Escaflowne is old, and if you haven't watched it yet, you should go do that, okay? Funimation re-released it recently and everything. It's great. So, yeah, like, Escaflowne, there's, like, the whole fate machine and giving in, like, I feel like Escaflowne in the end is supposed to be about, you know, we made this machine, it will give people what they desire, so that's a different kind of fate. But then, in the end, what people just desire to do, apparently, is fight with each other, and so then they go and break that because love is magical or whatever. Whereas I feel like this is actually a much more nuanced take on fate and defying and accepting it. Just because Escaflowne has many more magical things going on, I guess.
It's certainly a little less ridiculous, because then it does involve things like a 400-year-old Isaac Newton who's become this...
Yeah, Isaac Newton's not here, so...
And fate machines and that sort of thing. But unsurprisingly, for a series that's all about, like, princes and nobility and knights, there's a lot of emphasis on chivalry and on sacrifice. Because there's a lot of kind of knight and, I guess, protector pairings. I mean, there's Asta and Bad, there's Letty and Alex. And after Alex sacrifices himself, Letty and Latora, which I found interesting. You know, because it's the only time that a woman ends up in that kind of knightly role, even if it's not an official one.
Yeah.
And even the dragon men end up in similar roles, with Gaius being sort of a protector to Asta and Bad, and Sejanus to Azalin. And even, like, Winslet to Mielaine. That's probably the most straightforward expression of it.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, he becomes actually a sacrifice for her, even though he's like, I don't believe in curses. He's like, yeah, okay, I totally got cursed after hugging her. Yeah, I mean... I didn't fully form thoughts about chivalry and sacrifice, because in the end, really only, like, the bad people and accidental people got sacrificed.
Right, and because the others were willing to trust in their knightly figures, whether they're literal knights or not, they basically saved Asta and Letty and Azalin from, you know, this darker fate that was pushing them in this direction and end up undermining, you know, these dreadful plans. And then in their own way, they helped save the kingdom, even if they couldn't live to see its completion.
Oh, yeah. They're totally playing the there's a greater cause than my personal well-being. If I sacrifice myself, maybe I can save hundreds of thousands of others or whatever, however many people live in this kingdom. I don't know. maybe that will be it.
Fighting for the greater good.
Yeah, fighting for the greater good is definitely a prevalent theme in this. Something that I definitely wish our society currently took more into account with many things, but whatever.
Ain't that the truth?
So many things.
And then there was something else you brought up, which actually does come up not too infrequently when it comes to Japanese fantasy stories, which is dragons and similar sorts of supernatural forces as a metaphorical stand-in for nuclear power, for the atom bomb.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you got this feeling while reading it, but I definitely did, especially towards the beginning where they were talking about how back in the day, you know, the dragon tamers, like, they were like, well, one kingdom got a dragon, so then, of course, other kingdoms had to get a dragon, and then it just becomes like, but then if you employ the dragons, then you both just destroy each other, and I'm like, yep, that's how nuclear power works. You just have it, and then you don't actually want to use it, because if you do, you'll just end up mutually destroying each other, but you also can't not have it, because then one place could just destroy you, and I'm like, oh no. Oh, no.
Yeah, I wasn't struck by that while reading, but now that you bring it up, and I think about it, it's like, Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it became less... It felt less like that by the end where there were actual dragons fighting, but I think the way that they spoke about it initially made me think of that. So I was like, yeah, that's definitely... And, you know, I mean, I have that on my mind because obviously there's heightened tension with North Korea these days and everything. And, you know, South Korea is having the Olympics and I'm like, oh, that seems precarious, but okay.
But also... brings back to the theme of responsibly controlling it, then. Part of it is not just... because as they go over the history, they talk about these dragon tamers who would just resurrect these dragons basically just for the sake of having them fight one another and destroy everything, or taking the dragon's power onto themselves, just using this destructive power for their own selfish purposeness. And then you can contrast that with Asta, who ultimately... works with it for the greater good and doesn't necessarily take it onto himself. So there's a bit of a follow through, even if it gets a little lost in the second arc.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think, you know, it kind of like loses metaphorical resonance once you get to like the dragons do have some sentience. Like that's how Gaius and Sejanus sort of became a thing, where in their true dragon forms, they were like, well, the only way to stop these dragon tamers is to eat them, but now we've, like, kind of become them, and, you know, stuff like that, so, but I'm just like, yeah, I think generally in fantasy, because also, you know, this debate has come up in Game of Thrones as a more prevalent example of people being, like, Daenerys's dragons are just, like, nuclear power, and people debating about that and everything. I don't necessarily agree with that interpretation in, Game of Thrones, because I feel like the story just doesn't support it. But again, at least for the first half of this, I felt like the story supported that it was sort of a metaphor for nuclear power.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I don't know how purposeful that was in Shito's part, but it's definitely something you can read.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was our basic outline of themes. Do you have anything else that we should bring up in this segment before we do a not love quiz?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's not a lot of emphasis on romance in this one, so I guess the usual love quizzes don't really apply.
Yeah, I mean, there's some romance, right? But I'm like, but that's definitely not the main beat here.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no. So we decided that, you know, since this is really about coming into leadership roles, that we would take a, like, what leader are you quiz for Asta. We're going to take a quiz made by Staples, just because I think that's really funny.
Yeah, it's certainly not something I would have expected. It's like, it doesn't come from like a usual quiz site. It doesn't come from like a relevant magazine. It comes from an office supply store.
It comes from an office supply store, y'all. I mean, we could have done a normal one, but like Staples, guys, come on. All right, so this one is called Like a Boss. What type of boss are you? The little subheading is, as the boss, you're responsible for leading the people and processes that turn the wheels of commerce for your small business. How you do it depends on your leadership and management style. Take this fun quiz to find out about the types of bosses that exist and what kind you are. This promises to be fun, everybody. Let's go.
Woo!
Oh my god, the first question is, what's your favorite cocktail? The options are Long Island iced tea, because it really sneaks up on you, Old Fashioned, Purple Haze, Beer Flight, Martini, because you can make them by the pitcher to share, or Bloody Mary. I have to admit, I don't like drink, so I don't actually know a lot about alcohol.
Well, we see that Asta disapproves quite a lot of Bad's drinking, so I'd say whichever one sounds the least boozy.
The least boozy, okay. So is that like a Long Island iced tea? Like I
oh no, that's basically four kinds of alcohol with a bit of okay. Cola.
See, I know nothing. I was not joking.
An old fashioned involves whiskey. I'm trying to look the purple haze. If he was going to do anything, it would be I guess a stereotypically girly drink.
The martini. Or the Bloody Mary.
I'm trying to look at what a purple haze is. That's the only one I'm not familiar with. And yeah, it seems to be kind of in the same vein as like a vodka martini, where it's vodka based with fruit liqueurs. That would be my choice. That seems the closest.
Because fruit, okay. So Purple Haze, all right. Clicking it. Next question. Which business or career book would you most want to read? Ah, books. I understand books. That's what I work in. All right. The answers are The Art of War, Harvard Business Essentials, Coaching and Mentoring, How to Develop Top Talent and Achieve Stronger Performance, or Maximum Influence, The 12 Universal Laws of Power Persuasion, The Business Manager's Guide to Delegation, The 1 Minute Manager, or Honest Work, A Business Ethics Reader. Ooh, okay. Definitely not The Art of War.
Yes,
I can tell you that.
He's not a schemer. I'd say whichever one sounds the most... I'd probably go with Harvard Business Review, just because that sounds the most scholarly. And that's definitely more Asta's reading style. He's the kind who would probably, as a little kid, probably lost himself in encyclopedias.
Ah, that's interesting. I was also leaning towards Honest Work, just because he's so pure-hearted. But no, I can be convinced about Harvard Business Essentials. I think everything else is too, like, schemey for him, yeah. All right, Harvard Business Essentials. Click. All right. What makes you crazy at work? Nothing, because I'm hardly ever at work. Ooh. The fact that I so rarely know what's going on. Unrealized potential. Lack of control. Rule breakers. Everything. Well, definitely rule breakers,
yes,
right?
Yes.
He hates when Bad is womanizing and drinking. I think he's kind of is he a control freak? I don't know about that.
Not too much, but yeah, he's a bit prissy. He's not about, I guess, he's not about screwing off on the job.
Yeah. So definitely not the first one, because he definitely is always at work.
Yes.
He definitely knows what's going on, so I don't know. I think I might go with rule breakers.
I think that sounds wise myself.
Okay. Rule breakers. when the next question or statement, it's a statement that we have to complete. So it is, when my team does something worth celebrating, I congratulate them and note it on their performance records, point out specific contributions and make sure the top brass knows team members' names, take all the credit, find out about it later via email, point out what they could have done better, or act like I know what happened.
I feel like the second one is closest to Asta, because he's good at taking in input from different people and acknowledging that.
Yeah, certainly the last battle scene is him being like, I definitely respect all these more battle veterans, so I will take into account their opinion, but I will also try to come up with a scheme of my own to make sure that they don't get hurt and stuff. So, yeah, I agree. Point out specific contributions. All right. The next statement is, the animal most like me is the pack leader. I guide my team to survive and thrive. Border collie. I'm the smartest dog in the room and the one who keeps the sheep in line. No-see-um or biting midge. You may not be able to see me, but you know I'm around. Rattlesnake. I'm always ready to strike. Ostrich. I just bury my head and hope nothing bad happens. Worker bee. I like getting things done. Definitely not rattlesnake.
Border collie.
Border collie.
He's definitely a border collie.
And that's true.
In that he is smart, and when he's focused, he gets things done. But if he gets an idea of his own in his own head, he runs off.
That's true. And he's definitely not a pack leader or any of these other. He doesn't bury his head and run. Worker bee is a different side of him, I feel, but border collie is the one that best fits. Border collie. All right. Next question. Actually a question this time. Which of these things is always in your work area? A headset and a mobile hotspot so I can call in from anywhere. Oh, he wishes. He wishes to live in the future. Tissues, because I make so many people cry. Ouch. A coffee maker so I can chat about my team's career goals right in my office. The employee handbook so I can make sure we keep everything businesslike. A do not disturb sign so nobody asks me anything. Procedure manuals so I can prove when someone on my team is doing something wrong. All right, this one's hard.
It would definitely be the book based options.
The book, yeah. Procedure manual or employee handbook?
I know that's I'm trying to decide. He's not overly critical, so I'd go with the handbook.
Yeah, the end point of the procedure manual is, like, I think he would be good with that, but not to prove mm-hmm. that he did something wrong. Like, people did something wrong, yeah. All right.
Employee he would just handbook. Be the one to refer to it, like, no, if you look here, the subclause,
yeah,
do this thing.
In section 14B, subsection A, C, like, whatever. Yeah. But all right, employee handbook. That's what we've decided. All right, so next question. How do your employees describe you behind your back? Oh, wow. A, toxic. B, Dilbert. C, the shadow. D, controlling. E, supportive. F, Sarge.
I honestly, I would say Dilbert, because part of what motivates him is, as he goes on his travels, he hears how people describe him versus others. Everyone's like, oh, look at Duke Allen, look at Bardis, look at Letty, who is so bright and cheerful and can defend herself. And then there's Asta. It's like, oh, just that weird little kid who locks himself in the library and can't even fight.
Yeah. All right, yeah, I can agree with that. All right, Dilbert. All right, last question for all the everything. It's a statement. The managerial skill I'm best known for is dot, dot, dot. A, developing talent. B, being detailed. C, asking questions. D, giving orders. E, delegating. F, doing everything by the book. Being detailed?
By the book is close, but... And being detailed's not far off either, but I'd say asking questions.
Asking questions.
Because his willingness to learn from others and ask these difficult questions is basically what ends up saving him and the kingdom in the end.
That's true. Oh, I don't like when there are two good options. We could choose different ones. All right, I'll click being detailed, and you can go with asking questions. See if it sways the answers that we get. All right, the result that I have gotten is you're a mentor. Like Dr. Miranda Bailey from Grey's Anatomy. Perfect. I love it. A Forrester research report found that mentoring reduced turnover and recruiting costs, aided information transfer, and helped employees learn new skills. Keep developing great talent, but don't forget to tend to your own career chops, too.
I think that sounds right.
Yes, we've nailed it. That is what Asta is. So, you know, you want Asta to be your manager. He'd make a good manager. I would be down. Now it is shipping corner time. Even though this wasn't heavy on romance, there was some romance. There were some ships. There were also lots of ships you could make in your head that are fun. But first,
and
we can
the
talk
one
about
unifying
the real
theme
ones.
Is every romance is tragic.
Every romance is tragic. It's true. Yeah, there's no. None of these are actually turn out in the end, so, but we'll talk about whether they're good, bad, like them, love them, hate them. So we'll start off with the ones that actually do exist. So first one, the one that Letty wants to exist, Alex and Letty.
Oh,
I think they would have made, like,
Letty.
A good couple, but, you know, Alex doesn't want it, so that's not cool. Like, don't force it, Letty. Don't force it.
It's basically just a teenage crush. And Alex is fully aware of this, so good on him. He's fully aware that, you know, she's a teenage girl, and not to mention above his station. And he really does try to be sensitive about it and not hurt her feelings.
I know, I do like the level of sensitivity. Yeah, even though it may not have been the right choice in the end, right? But he tried.
It ends up hurting him, sometimes literally, but...
Very literally. But yeah, no, I'm like, they would have been cute together, but I enjoy his level of respect for his own feelings, both for his own feelings and for Letty's feelings, even though he did not reciprocate that crush. I dig it.
And as for Letty, it ended up being, you know, something to help her realize a lot about herself and her own priorities, and she's basically the sadder but wiser girl.
Yeah, I really wish it didn't have to take away... so hard, all of her bubbliness, but, you know, stories. So then there's Alex and Latona, which is also, like, she's not super into it, right?
The problem is they don't necessarily get a lot of scenes together just on their own, so we don't get to see them together too much. I would have been perfectly okay with that. Like, not just because it was more age appropriate, but like they seem to get along just fine. It's hard to say much more because we don't see a lot of them together. And if we do, we see it from Letty's kind of magic enhanced perspective, which only highlights kind of the negative parts that's just feeding into her jealousy and her insecurity about her age.
Yeah, and I feel like it's not even so much that we don't even see them together that often, but we don't even see them. They're just not like super major characters. Like Letty is already her side story is already kind of relegated to only a few scenes. So then within that, getting Alex and Latona is kind of like, oh yeah, like you only get very few scenes with them together. So, you know, it's all told through inferences that you make on your own. Like Alex is very pretty and he's a knight and he's very chivalrous, and Latona is the granddaughter of a mystic, but she's also smart and like kind of
a little more down, you know, to earth, a little
discerning, yeah, a little more suspicious and whatever of her grandfather's motives in the end. But yeah, I could see them together, but you know, I had no strong feelings about it. Yeah, it's basically in the end, which I think is a nice contrast actually to Winslet and Mia, because again, they only get a chapter, but in that chapter, I feel like it did a really good job of, you know, convincing you of the love at first sight thing and like their motivations for falling for each other.
Oh, it's pure fairy tale romanticism, a knight and his princess. And they're both so pretty. So pretty.
They are really pretty. Oh, it's so good. I would have loved to see them together, but also, you know, tragic romance is tragic.
Oh, the one thing I did like is that Mia Lane gets to live to the end. You know, she doesn't die or is reduced by Winslet's sacrifice. She gets to live and to help Asta in his quest and to eventually become a ruler in her own right.
Yeah, I really liked that in the end. They were like, and she's queen. And I was like, oh, for some reason I didn't expect that, but cool. I guess I was surprised more that it was like she becomes queen. And there's no mention of, like, whoever she marries being more important and stuff. I was like, cool. I like it. I dig it. Like, she made the decision in the end to reunite Rommel with Landor, I guess. Yeah. At least that's how I interpreted that little, like, one sentence thing that happens at the end.
And then there's a ship that you didn't feel very strongly for, but I'm actually pretty okay with, which is Asta and Letty.
Really? You wanted that to happen?
Yeah, they're both a couple of good, cute kids, and they do get along, and Letty's very good at kind of bringing out Asta's good qualities, particularly early on. Because most of his insecurities regarding her and her abilities are his alone. It's not like she's teasing him about it. It's just him feeling insecure.
It's true.
But they do support each other in very good, constructive ways.
Yeah, no, I think that the way that the story went in the end made me feel better that they didn't end up in the end, just because I feel like that would have been, I mean, you can imagine that they ended up together in the end, right? Like with the time skip, but I'm glad that at the end of their present day arcs, it didn't end up that way, because I feel like they were both just in such a sad place that to give them that would have been strangely not tragic and whatever, like it wouldn't have felt appropriate to me, I guess. But generally, I feel like they would make a great couple. Yeah, like that's fine.
Yeah, I actually just had to look through my volume 6 really quick. It's like, is there even like a brief image that, like, there's one flash forward, I think, when Bad is having his big death speech to Asta, that shows like Asta, yeah, as an old man with like grandchildren and all that, and there's a woman in the background, and maybe you could presume that's Letty, but we don't see her face, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, I definitely think it left you room to interpret that could have happened.
Yeah.
But I definitely did not spell it out in the end. Also, are they cousins? At least at one point they said they were cousins.
I mean, she is of royal lineage, but it's not said how closely.
Yeah, maybe they're like distant cousins.
Of course, you know, they're...
Because if they're like first cousins, I'm like,
yeah, that's less of an issue for the Japanese readers, but
yeah. But I guess now we can go on to our in our head ships, because I think there are a lot of queer ships that you can easily make in your mind. And the easiest that we have pointed out are Gaius and Bod, and Aslan and Seonis. And I ship both of those, yes. I dig it.
I didn't get so much with Gaius and Bad, but oh god, Aslan really? And Seonis is just pure tragic Fujo bait.
It definitely
like, I can easily see their storyline just on its own being like this very romantic, ethereal BL story.
Oh yeah, totally. Especially since Seonis definitely... I feel like he started looking more and more like a woman by the end. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I just had weird goggles on.
It's emphasized early on that both of the dragon men are very androgynous looking, which Shito's art helps a lot. Like, she already draws in this very delicate 90s style, but she goes all out with those two. And they're just gorgeous and ethereal. And I can see where you get it with Gaius and Bad. There's a little more give and take between them. And particularly once Bad makes his Faustian bargain with Gaius to sacrifice his own life to help advance Asta's cause.
I definitely just got it from, like, whatever, I don't know. Like, I liked their banter with each other, and Bod just being like, Gaius just follows me around and I just let him, like a little puppy or whatever.
Yeah, Bad likes kind of poke Gaius the same way he likes to poke Asta, just as far as attitude and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, Aslan and Seonis is just pure, beautiful, romantic tragedy. Where since Seonis is the more aggressive of the two dragon men initially, the one being like, we have to destroy these humans before they cause the end of the world. But his mindset is forced to change when she meets Aslan, who is not only not able to be affected by dragon magic, but is willing to listen and address Seonis' concerns. And they do become friends, and, you know, it wouldn't take much of too much of a logical leap to translate this into something a little more Fujo-friendly.
Definitely. I definitely got those vibes more and more, especially as Seonis turned more and more to being like, I can't kill him, I guess I have to, like, play his game and, like, just stay by him, and why do I feel things for him? Like, why do I feel enough to sacrifice myself?
I have to protect him for the cost of my own life.
I know, like, oh, why though? Like, I definitely liked that dynamic. But I mean, Gaius and Bad in the end, like, fuse together, and I'm like, yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
Oh god, I didn't even think of that angle.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of angles. I guess the one that I didn't write down in our Google Doc, though, was also that in the beginning, with more flashbacks to Winslot, I was like, I could ship Winslot and Bad, too. Like, I could see it.
Oh, totally. And again, that goes back to that whole knight and retainer thing. Like, oh, I will fight for you and protect you. And
yeah, there was one line in particular about, like, laying down lives or something about laying down something with Winslot, and I was like, yeah, you definitely laid with Winslot, didn't you?
It's not so much pervy, but it's definitely, there's definitely a lot of courtly love going on.
Definitely. So do we have a, like, one true pairing here, or are we just like, yeah, those are all fun? I guess you definitely are, like, Aslan and Seonis. Woo.
Honestly, that's the one I feel strongest about, but since it's not really a shippy series, it's not one I feel like super strongly about, like, no, you have to protect these two at all costs.
Yeah, that's true. There's not really an OTP like that I'd fight for, yeah. But, you know, definitely some fun ships to do in your head with this one. I feel like you can do it with any of the, like, random knight people, too, that come at the end, like Gear, is that his name? He's fun. So do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to get out before we go to the outro?
There's nothing else I can really think of other than if you want to talk more about the art, because I think we've only really briefly touched upon that. And the artwork is so beautiful, and it's kind of a shame we couldn't see more of Shito's stuff. Because, as I've mentioned, the character designs are kind of retro, but she puts so much detail into it.
Yeah, and even beyond that, just the way that she sometimes laid out pages to, like, Trying to remember a specific instance. I definitely took some on my phone. Oh, my phone in my pocket. Maybe I can scroll through them. But just like, you know, laying out how all five contenders went to a different invisible tower. Like, I thought there were some good spreads with that. Or like, I guess the one that I'm thinking of is about, you know, learning that the dragon tamers and the dragons had fused together, showing like a dragon growing out of a human in dark silhouette. I really liked that page a lot. Like,
yes. Yes, a lot of like the historical, yeah, the historical flashbacks and montages. There's a lot of good montages like that and spreads, as you mentioned. But I just really appreciate all the detail she put into the character models, the costumes, the backgrounds. Like, she's a really skilled, talented artist.
I know. Oh, yeah. Like, I love all their, like, knight costumes. I love Letty's clothes and everything. It's really good. I'm just scrolling through. I like her style of funny.
Oh, yeah. But also what struck me are just the dragon fights. And she doesn't necessarily do a lot of huge spreads or anything, but she just really captures the struggle of dragons being born from the earth and thrashing about in agony, or just these worms just wrapping and fighting around one another in the air like snakes. And oh God, I love it so much.
Oh, yeah, it's really, yeah, the arts, I just... It's so sad that to think that she's not doing manga anymore. I'm like, no. I would definitely read more by you.
Also, I do want to comment on the translation. I do think the translation works really well. Other than the reoccurring use of shite.
Oh, yeah.
As a curse.
Yeah.
Which is
definitely
little...
like you're trying too hard here.
That was something CMX tended to do with their translations, just because they had company policy where everything had to be teen or lower.
Oh.
But I do think it captures that kind of high fantasy style without being too ostentatious about it.
Yeah, I definitely liked how they spoke. Like, it wasn't overbearing, but it was funny enough to be like, ah, yes, fantasy speak, old school fantasy speak. It's real fun.
And I looked it up afterwards. The person who did the translation adaptation is a guy named Sheldon Drizka. He actually did, if you look through his, I guess, CV on ANN, you'll find he worked on a lot of very notable titles from CMX. He translated titles like Land of the Blindfolded and Phantom Thief Jean when they released as Kamikaze Kaito Jean, and Emma by Kaoru Mori. Like a lot of kind of the best and brightest from CMX. And he's still working these days. He does a lot with Yen Press. He did their retranslation of Fruits Basket.
Oh, and, man, I need to read that. Yeah.
And he also does some work for Kodansha, including on, you know, a little title. You might have heard of it. Something called Attack on Titan.
Attack on Titan. Nah, never heard of that. That's not a shoujo manga.
I know, it's super obscure.
It's very obscure, yeah.
But he's even done some like TV translate. He's done sub translations for stuff like Fairy Tale and March Comes in Like a Lion. So he's keeping busy, and he's clearly a good translator, not necessarily like one of the best known.
Yeah,
but I appreciate his work.
I've definitely heard really good things about the new Fruits Basket. Yeah, I'm trying to think of anything else that I really liked about the art or anything. No, I definitely just like being transported back into the 90s, like Uwatase, early Uwatase feeling.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else. I think we're ready to go into the final thoughts.
Thanks for listening to Shoujo and Tell. Comments, questions, constructive criticism, concerns? Need to gush about your OTP or some semblance of OTP? Any queer shipping you liked out of this? Email shoujoandtell@gmail.com or leave a comment on shoujoandtell.com/keytothekingdom. We're at Shoujo and Tell on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Still figuring out Instagram. Please forgive me. I'm curmudgeonly about new social media services. So this is a newish podcast, so it'd be great if you could leave a review in iTunes. This will help the podcast reach more hearts, or at least ears. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next time for some various one-volume manga by Arina Tanimura. I'm sure there will be lots of idols involved. And angels? I don't know. You'll have to find out for next episode. Stay tuned. Bye.
Bye.